I start paddling back to the dock as fast as I can, but then I see a flood of students running toward it. I shriek and dive under as they all jump over my head, diving, falling, and cannonballing into the water. When I pop back up, almost all the other seventh graders are splashing and swimming around me, squealing at how cold it is. Phoebe helps Victoria into the water, and then the captains jump in, whooping, looking for seventh graders to dunk. Pull it together, Amelia. Maybe that wasn't a memory at all. Maybe it was just a moment of panic from the surprise of being chucked into a freezing lake. Still, it takes a few minutes before the shakiness leaves me. The lake starts to feel a little warmer, and the rising sun turns it to liquid gold. I try to enjoy the swim, basking in the beauty of the setting. I'm determined to enjoy this day, no matter what. But then I see Darby sitting on the dock by Victoria's empty wheelchair. Darby's legs dangle over the side, and she watches her reflection as if the rest of us aren't even here. I know she's thinking of Amelia Jones. My gut twists. I didn't even know the other Amelia Jones existed until yesterday, but we are connected in such a big way. We have the same name, and I have her acceptance letter. I'm even rooming with her best friend. It's like I took over the life she was supposed to have. I wonder what other Amelia would think of me taking her place. I wonder if she dreamed about this day for as long as I have. And I realize then that if it would bring that other Amelia back, I'd give all of this up in a heartbeat. It belongs to her, not me. I didn't earn this. She did. But I've never heard of a spell that can bring back the dead. Chapter 10. A tough octave to follow. Later that day, the older students start arriving. The Mistwick campus, which had seemed so huge and empty and quiet, now fills up with noisy kids who call out to each other, greeting friends they haven't seen all summer. They walk around like they own the campus, knowing exactly where to go and how to get there. I, on the other hand, feel like an actual guppy, flitting between schools of much bigger, louder fish. But that's okay, because all I want right now is to blend in until the maestros can't possibly tell me apart from everyone else. The perfect Mistwick musician. It helps that we all wear the same uniforms. Navy blue skirts or pants, white knee-high socks, the blue cardigan with the Mistwick crest on the front. Though my uniform doesn't quite fit right. They must have guessed at my measurements. Or maybe they were meant for the other Amelia. The clothes are all too big, so I have to roll up the sleeves of the cardigan. And the shiny black shoes they found for me were too small, so I'm still wearing my old scruffy hiking boots, since standing to play flute for hours each day requires comfy footwear, and I'm not sure who I'm supposed to ask for new shoes. To escape the chaos after our orientation classes end, I go to the library. It's a 3-story building completely made of glass, so it reflects the forest and mountains on every side, blending into the landscape. The moment I set foot through the doors, my whole body relaxes. I can tell at once that this library is going to be my favorite place at Mistwick. On the first floor is regular books, and there are tons of them. I walk up and down the aisles, taking out everything I can find that might help me pass Mrs. LaRue's test, and a few just for fun. My favorites are stories about music craft, of course, adventures about spells gone wrong, biographies of famous maestros, histories of musical incidents that changed the world, like when the Allied Military Symphony defeated the Axis powers in World War II, or when Leif Erikson, the Viking, found North America by playing a spell he learned from a raven, or how the ancient Japanese used elemental magic to raise typhoons that repelled the invading Mongolians. When my arms are so full of books I can hardly see over them, I pause and look around. Where are the spells? Hearing a laugh behind me, I turn to see Miss March pushing a cart of books. So she's the dean of students and the librarian, it seems. Go upstairs, she says. You'll see. I leave my stack of books on a table, where I'll pick them up on the way down. Then I race up the stairs and find myself in paradise. Spells upon spells upon spells. The entire second floor is devoted to them. For a whole minute, I just stand and gape like a stunned frog. Rows of shelves hold books of spells. Spells on loose paper, spells rolled into little scrolls and tied with string, spells of every color and type, some modern, some hundreds of years old. Classical and jazz and rock and folk, and genres I've never heard of. Spells for full orchestras and solo spells for instruments of every imaginable type. I've never seen so many in one place. I had no idea so many existed. When I can finally move my feet, I roam around, touching them like they're made of the most fragile glass. I could spend a lifetime on just one shelf. There must be a spell in here for everything, and they're just waiting for a musician to come along and bring them to life. Maybe if I fail out of Mistwick, they'll let me stay as a janitor or something, and pay me in library loans. I'd do anything just to never leave this building again.
"Amelia Bethany Jones," says a voice. "You know, I guessed you were a library kind of person."
I turn and see Jai walking over, his violin case slung on his back by its long strap. It's not Bethany. And what's wrong with libraries? You're here.
"Yeah, but not for books."
"There are thousands of spells here." He sighs and looks around.
"And I just know they're going to make us learn them all."
"Don't you want to?" I take a deep breath and suck in that wonderful papery smell. "I'm never leaving. Never, ever, ever, ever. You'll have to drag me out of here with a forklift." He groans.
"I'm going up to the third floor. Are you coming?"
"Are there more spell books on the third floor?"
"Better," he says. "There's a computer lab and internet."
This is the first I've been able to contact Gran. Before I left, I made her an email account just for this purpose. I write her a quick message, telling her I'm fine and how beautiful it is here and about the echo trees. I don't tell her about the other Amelia, or the mixed-up acceptance letter, or my deal with Mrs. LaRue, or that my staying here is all due to some mysterious voice. No one else has mentioned hearing the echo trees talk to them, so I'm not sure it'd be a good idea to bring it up again, especially not to Gran. I'm pretty sure I just imagined the whole thing anyway. The way I see it, there isn't anything she can do to help me, and if she thinks I'm in trouble, she might even make me come home. What harm can come from waiting until after my 2-month test before coming clean? After sending the email, I glance at Jai's computer to see he's engrossed in music videos of rock concerts, with musicians playing so hard their drumsticks break and their guitar strings snap. Rock spells usually produce illusion magic, so the air around them sparks with glittering shapes. Dragons and horses and ocean waves. Entire stories told through music craft. Better than any movie. Jai watches like he's entranced. "You taking a rock class?" I ask.
"Huh?"
He looks up like I startled him, then shakes his head and quickly closes the window.
"Yeah, right. My dad would only die of embarrassment if he caught me in a rock class."
Sighing, he opens a zombie game instead and leans low over the keyboard, his tongue sticking out as he chops heads and limbs with a pixelated machete. Shaking my head, I open the internet and go to a website where people share MusicCraft videos. Then I hesitate, my stomach squeezing. For a minute, I think maybe I'm not brave enough. But then I type quickly before I can change my mind and hit search. She comes up right away. Tall for her age, long dark hair, an absolutely perfect posture. The other Amelia Jones. There are tons of videos of her playing piano, and they all have thousands of views. Amelia Jones playing in Vienna. Amelia Jones playing for the President of the United States. Amelia Jones winning a TV MusicCraft competition. She wasn't just good. She was a legend. I'd probably have heard of her, too, if I watched more TV, but I was always so focused on practicing, I never had much time for it. But even still, her face is kind of familiar, and I think I've seen her on magazines at the grocery store checkout lines. There's a pair of headphones by the computer, and I pop them on and then play one of the videos. 3 minutes later, I realize the video ended 30 seconds ago, and I'm still sitting in shock. The other Amelia was good. Like, really, really good. No wonder she got accepted into Mistwick. She played better than most adults, even as well as most maestros. And though piano seemed to be her specialty, she could play dozens of instruments, all of them with the same level of perfection. There's a video of her playing a spell that fills an entire auditorium with light, and another where she plays in a hospital ward for a sick little boy. In minutes, he jumps out of his bed, fully healed by her spell. It seems her specialty was healing spells, curing people who everyone thought were beyond hope. What would it be like to have that kind of power? To be loved by so many people? I scroll through the comments. Angel. Prodigy. A gift from heaven, the best young pianist in the world. Farther down, there are newer comments, which take a different tone. I'm still in shock. I can't believe she's gone. It's so unfair. I heard it was murder. They say they never even found her body. Those comments make me feel sick, so I go to close the window. But then my eye snags on something that makes me pause. I click it, and the screen fills with another video of Amelia. But this time, instead of a grand concert hall, she's in a living room, dressed in pajamas. She's playing some kind of illusion spell on a white grand piano. Every few seconds, she looks up at someone across the room and laughs, but I can't see who it is. Finally, the camera moves just slightly to get a better angle of Amelia's face, and then I see her, Darby. She's also in her pajamas, so I guess they were having a sleepover or something. And Darby is waving a baton, like she's conducting Amelia. The illusion spell is focused on her, making her hair turn all different colors. I stare at the Darby in the video. She seems like a whole different person. Happy, fun, even silly. She makes a goofy face, and the two laugh their heads off without Amelia ever missing a note. She follows Darby's direction, playing faster and slower. Finally, the video ends with the pair of them standing on the piano bench and taking bows. Judging by the date on the video, it was taken just a few months before Amelia died. Letting out a shaky breath, I realize Jai is watching. Meanwhile, his game avatar is getting mauled by zombies.
"I remember her now," he says. "That's why your name sounded familiar to me at the audition. She was good.
She was beyond good," says another voice. We both turn, and my stomach drops. Darby stands there, holding her shakuhachi case and a book of Japanese illusion spells. I want to say something, anything, to make her feel better. After seeing what she was like before the other Amelia died, I now know how much she must be hurting. How much it changed her. I know what that feels like. I know what it is to wake up in the morning and think everything is okay, everything's normal. And then you remember. You remember who is missing, and your stomach drops, and the world turns gray, and you want to smash your face into a pillow and scream. I want to tell her that even 8 years later, I still feel that way sometimes. But before I can think of what to say, Darby whispers,
"She was the best there was."
With a sigh, she turns and walks away. She passes a table where Claudia and Victoria and some other seventh graders are sitting, and they whisper as she goes by. Claudia's running some sort of gossip ring and loves to tell anyone who will listen about the tragic death of the other Amelia Jones, as if she'd been the girl's best friend. "Hey, Darby," Claudia calls. "Come sit with us." But Darby ignores them and goes down the stairs, looking angry. Turning back around, I prop my head in my hands. My stomach has sunk to the floor.
I shouldn't be here, I say to Jai. He tilts his head. What are you talking about?
I let my hands fall to the desk, but can't quite look him in the eyes. A part of me wants to tell him the truth, that my being here is just a huge mistake. But even thinking about it makes my ears burn. If everyone found out about my secret, they'd all look at me differently. Not like I was one of them, but like I was a fraud. And coming from Jai, that look would hurt most of all. He's my first friend here, and I don't want to lose that. All I have to do is pass Mrs. LaRue's test in 2 months, and then it won't matter anymore. It'll be like I got in the same way as everyone else. I just have to make sure no one sees through me till then, not even Jai. I just don't want to mess up, you know, like at the hotel.
Ah, well, just avoid drying spells then.
He shrugs, his fingers jamming the keys as he navigates a zombie-infested street.
Or you'd probably burn down the whole school.
I punch his arm, and he yelps like his bones are broken and falls to the floor.
Amelia Jones has slain me,
he moans.
Have pity, have pity. I'm just a poor boy from a poor family.
The kids behind us all shush him angrily. And Jai stands and directs an elaborate bow in their direction, basking in their glares.
Ah, my fans,
he sighs, sliding back into his chair.
It's tough being loved by so many.
Dork.
That's Mr. Dork to you, Jones.
Jai grins and goes back to playing his game. I nibble my pencil, thinking about the other Amelia, trying to imagine what she was like. Not as a celebrity or a miracle worker, but just as a person. The way Darby knew her. I wonder how she would have fit in here at Mistwick. Something tells me that even here, with all these super talented kids, she'd have stood out. A big fish in a little pond. But I feel like I'm being swallowed up. Back home, I never felt that way. I could play every spell Mrs. Parrish put in front of me. I was always ahead in music craft class, and I practiced twice as much as everyone else. I thought I was good. Now, I'm not sure what I am, or what I have to do to fit in. This is harder than I'd ever dreamed it could be. And it feels like every move I make, I've got the maestros watching over my shoulder and taking notes. Is she good enough? Is she Mistwick material? Or is she just a mistake to be erased? But even more importantly, it's like I can feel my mom watching too, asking the same questions. Chapter 11, Gone with the Woodwinds. The next morning, school officially begins. My first period is homeroom, which I share with the other woodwind students, or arrows. I get lost in Harmony Hall looking for it, and when I finally arrive at the right place, most of the kids are already there, talking and laughing. The room is long, and the walls are sculpted for optimum acoustics. A long picture window gives a view of the mountains and the lake. The other wall is lined with clear, fully enclosed cubicles, sort of like old-fashioned telephone booths that I'm guessing are soundproof for individual spell work. Every desk has an apple on it, which I take to be a nice, welcoming gesture by our homeroom maestro, who is apparently not yet here. There is only one desk still empty, at the very front of the classroom, beside Darby. Hey, I say, trying to be as cheery as possible. You were up early this morning? By early, I mean the crack of dawn. Darby was gone before I even woke up, her bed made up so neatly it would make Gran cry with happiness. She just gives me a little nod and stares at her desk. Claudia wanders over and snickers. Nice shoes, Jones. Or can I even call them that? You some kind of construction worker back home? I yank my feet under my chair, but it's too late to hide my scruffy boots. Looking around, I notice all the others are wearing the same shiny uniform shoes. Not a scuff of dirt on any of them.
Cut it out, Claudia. Darby snaps, surprising me.
Claudia laughs and picks up Darby's apple, tossing it lightly and catching it again.
You know, it's weird, isn't it? You and Amelia, the other one, were supposed to be roommates, and then you get some other Amelia Jones instead. Seems like an odd coincidence.
Yeah,
Darby says softly.
It does.
I swallow hard and lower my face as a hot, rashy feeling sweeps from my cheeks to my toes. My hands squeeze together between my knees. Everyone is still talking when our maestro arrives. Mr. Pinwhistle glares around at us, then stomps in, slamming his large bassoon case onto his desk at the front. Claudia quickly slides back into her chair.
I will have silence, he says. And when I enter the room, you will greet me with respect.
Yes, maestro, a few people mutter.
What?
He says, holding a hand to his ear. Yes, maestro, we all shout. He grunts and sits heavily, his chair creaking beneath him.
Let's get one thing straight,
Mr. Pinwhistle says, slapping his desk.
This is not some artsy-fartsy music craft camp where we sit around talking about how music makes us feel. Mistwick is for serious musicians and serious magic. There will be no crying, whining, excuses, eating, cheating, tardiness, talking out of turn, passing notes, vandalizing school property, chewing gum, stupidity, laziness, late homework, or bathroom breaks.
I'm not sure that last one is entirely legal to ban, but I don't think now is the best time to bring it up.
At the end of each week,
Mr. Pinwhistle says,
you'll be listed according to chair, based on your performance in class and on homework.
He smacks a finger on a chart by the door, where all our names are written on little cards. I notice there are 26 slots instead of 25, and wonder if anyone else notices that an extra flute was added to the class. I sink a little lower in my chair.
First chair to last. Oh, and did I mention? Last chair gets double homework.
I stifle a groan. He may as well go ahead and hand me my assignment. I heard these kids play during the planting ceremony, so I know what I'm up against. Still, I'd rather play a million extra hours of practice scales than be expelled. Mr. Pinwhistle hands out spells to each of us based on our instruments. Mine is an etude called Barcarolle by Friedrich Burgmüller, which I've never heard of before, but it doesn't look too difficult. It's a yellow spell that's supposed to peel, unwrap, or open an object. I glance at the apple on my desk.
Now, as any toddler can tell you, growls Mr. Pinwhistle, there are four types of spells. What are they?
He looks around until his eyes land on me.
Jones?
Everyone stares at me. Claudia's eyes burn into me from one side, and Darby's from the other. Ears burning, I sit up straighter and say, the four types of spells are green, yellow, blue, and white.
And who will define green spells for us?
He nods at another flutist in the back.
You. Who are you?
I'm Jing Fei. The girl stands up and says in a clear voice, green spells are also known as biospells. They work on living organisms, people, animals, plants. They affect biological processes, healing, or causing growth, or inflicting pain and withering. Mr. Pinwhistle grunts, nods, and turns to another student.
And yellow spells? They let us move things,
the boy says quietly. Mr. Pinwhistle sighs.
Name?
The boy's cheeks turn red.
Colin Brunnings? Colin Brunnings,
mutters Mr. Pinwhistle, going to the chart by the door. He finds Colin's card and moves it into last place. Everyone falls very quiet. I sit up a little straighter, trying not to grin. At least it's not me in the last spot.
In this class, Colin,
growls Mr. Pinwhistle,
we will be specific in our answers. So who can tell me what yellow spells do specifically?
Claudia raises her hand. Yellow spells, or kinetic spells, manipulate objects. They summon, repel, levitate, ward. They can even teleport. But those are very hard to play and can end in disaster if you mess up. You have to have a special license for teleportation spells. The rest of the answers come quickly, as Mr. Pinwhistle calls on other students. This is all basic stuff. Even so, I take notes furiously, making sure to be very specific. "Blue spells are elemental," says a girl named Aya. "They let you call up wind or fire and affect the weather. They can also be illusion spells because they conjure light and darkness."
"White spells influence the mind,"
a boy named George explains as he pushes his glasses up his nose.
"They're also called mental spells. They can charm and enchant, put you to sleep or fog your memory. And they let some people see the future."
"That's not true," Claudia cries out.
"It is. My grandmother knew a spell that could—"
"Enough,"
grumbles Mr. Pinwhistle.
"It's true some musicians can use certain spells to discern events to come, albeit these so-called visions are usually murky and unreliable."
Darby pipes up softly. "Some people believe in a fifth kind of spell, black spells." Everyone turns to stare at her. Mr. Pinwhistle makes a noise in his throat like he has something stuck there.
"They let you talk to ghosts," Darby goes on, "or resurrect the dead, steal souls, stuff like that."
"Like the Necromuse," says George. "He uses black spells."
Everyone whispers, and a few kids look frightened. "What's the Necromuse?" I whisper to George, whose desk is behind mine. He leans forward and replies,
"Your worst nightmare, Jones."
I roll my eyes. "Very helpful, thanks." Mr. Pinwhistle's face has turned red.
"Miss Bradshaw, we at Mistwick do not trade in fairy tales. There are no such thing as black spells, and attempting them here will result in severe consequences. Now, we'll speak no more about that."
He slaps Darby's card into the last chair slot, bumping up Colin Brunnings, who lets out a relieved sigh. "Huh." I lean back in my chair, tapping my pencil to my lip. If there's no such thing as black spells, why would it be against the rules to try them? Mr. Pinwhistle gives us a few minutes to tune up, then splits us into two groups. The first group heads into the little cubicles with the clear plastic walls, while my group waits for our turn. I watch curiously as the students in the cubicles play over their apples, which they place on little clear shelves inside. I can't hear a single note from any of them. Those walls must be thicker than they look. Each cubicle fills with sparkling motes of green light, the magic bouncing around in the small spaces. Behind me, George whispers,
"Can you imagine farting in there?"
He and the boys around him crack up until Mr. Pinwhistle makes a growling noise. Darby finishes first, holding up her perfectly peeled apple. But she doesn't smile. Mr. Pinwhistle nods with satisfaction and moves her up two chairs, putting Colin back in last place. Finally, it's my turn. I shut the cubicle door and prop the spell on a stand in the corner. The apple goes on the shelf. Before I start, I hold my flute in position and practice the spell silently, clicking the keys and hearing the notes in my head. Once I'm sure of the melody, I begin. But I only get three notes into the spell before the sheets in front of me suddenly slip off their stand, falling to the floor. My heart jumps into my throat. I grab them up and replace them, then pick up where I left off. Again, I barely even start playing, and the pages leap off the stand. I glance around to see the students in the other booths aren't having any trouble. There isn't an air vent in here, or any other way a draft might have blown in. And I hadn't gotten far enough into the spell yet to produce any magic. Weird. Quickly setting up the papers, I try again. This time, a gust of wind rushes around the booth, sweeping away the papers and pulling at my hair and clothes. I shout, grabbing at the sheets, and end up knocking my funny bone on the door handle. Yelping with pain, I throw out a hand for support and knock my apple to the floor. The pages rush all around me, beating at me like enraged birds. Shrieking, I bat them away with one hand and try to hold down my skirt with the other as the wind rushes around my legs. The door flies open and the wind dissipates. Mr. Pinwhistle is standing there, face red. I realize all the other students have finished their spells and are sitting at their desks staring at me as my spell sheets gently drift to the floor and my apple rolls out. Mr. Pinwhistle stops it with his shoe, then picks it up and holds it between us. It's covered in dark bruises, and not so much as a sliver of the peel has been removed. I stare at it, then him, at a loss for words. What just happened? It wasn't my playing that started that wind. It's almost like someone was playing a trick on me. But it doesn't make sense. I was alone in there, and no other spells could have worked through the soundproof walls. Mr. Pinwhistle looks disgusted.
Miss Jones, if you aren't going to take this seriously, perhaps you should reconsider why you're here at all.
But didn't you see that?
Sit down, Miss Jones.
A few people snicker. And it's clear they thought I was the one making the wind. Or maybe it just looked like I was being clumsy, dropping my papers everywhere.
What a tragedy, Claudia says.
I don't know what to say to Mr. Pinwhistle. I can tell arguing will only make things worse. So I mumble an apology, promising not to do it again, even though I didn't do anything. Somebody booby-trapped the booth or something. I have no idea how, but I do know who used it before me, Darby Bradshaw. I watch her closely, but she isn't even paying attention to me. She's just staring at her desktop. Is that a sign of guilt? Does she suspect my secret? Mr. Pinwhistle firmly plants my name at the bottom of the chair list, and there it remains until the end of class, when he calls me to his desk. He wasn't kidding about the extra homework part. That evening, what little free time I have left after all the extra work I had to do, I spend in the library. It's not so busy now, because most of the students are hanging out in the gym or common areas. And I guess it's still early enough in the year that people aren't cramming for tests. I try to call Gran from the library phone, but only get her voicemail. My throat closes up when I try to speak, and I only manage to squeak, "Hi, Gran, it's me. I'll call again later." I send her another email instead, and find it's much easier to lie that way. "This place is amazing," I write. "I've made so many friends and am doing really well in all my classes. There's nothing to worry about, not a single thing. Everything is totally fine." After a moment's thought, I erase the last two sentences, imagining Gran's nose wrinkling up as she squints through her glasses, reading between the lines. "I miss you a lot," I write instead. "The banana pudding here isn't half as good as yours. Anyway, better go. Lots of homework. Love, Amelia." After sending the email, I go downstairs. I have to find something to do a report on for my literature class and end up in the fairy tale section. My fingers trail along the spines. The Little Siren, Snow White and the Seven Drummers, Aladdin and the Wonderful Lute, the Pied Piper of Hamelin. I can't stop thinking about the spell I flubbed in homeroom and that stupid apple rolling over the floor. And the rest of my classes today drove home one undeniable fact. I'm not as good as these kids are. Maybe with a lot of practice, I could be. But can I really improve that much in just 2 months? Am I wasting everyone's time by even trying? What if I'm just fooling myself and should give up now? Then my fingers pause on a slender blue book, The Magic Flute. I take down the book and crack it open, recognizing the illustrations, because it's the same edition as the one I have at home. It's the story of a prince and an enchanted flute that could transform sadness into joy, and how he rescued his love by playing the most wonderful spells. When I was smaller, I used to read this one over and over, until I could repeat whole sections from memory. But as much as I love this one, I need something longer for my book report. I start to close it, but then a card slips out the back. I bend over to pick it up and freeze. It's one of those old cards people used to write their names on when they checked out a book. The list is old because everything's done with barcodes now. The dates are all from 20 years ago. But it's not the dates that catch my attention. It's the name that practically leaps out at me. Susan Jones. I gasp, staring at the little card like it's a $1 million bill. She checked it out 7 times, like it was her favorite book, too. My hands start to shake. I sink to the floor, cradling the book, gripping it until the pages crinkle. She held this. She read it over and over. She came to this spot, took it off this shelf, stood right here. I turn through every page, in case there are any other signs she left behind. But all I find are smudges left by dirty fingers. They could be anyone's. I slowly close the book, staring at the worn cover and imagining it in her hands. I can feel her so intensely at that moment that it's like her arms are around me. And I realize I can't give up. Because if I do, I'll spend the rest of my life never knowing who I really am. Am I my mother's daughter, or am I my father's? Do I stick by my dreams, or do I run away when things get hard, the way he did? If I get expelled from Mistwick, let it be because I wasn't good enough, not because I was a coward. Chapter 12. The Second Rule of Music Craft. On our first Friday morning, all the seventh graders gather in the main auditorium, called the Shell. It's the huge vaulting concert hall at the far end of campus, shaped kind of like an armadillo shell. The whole seventh grade class fills up only one small section of the seats. In front of us is an enormous stage, dark except for a lone spotlight shining down on a microphone stand. I slump in my seat, yawning from staying up late to study my homework. I sat for hours in the dorm's shared bathroom, feet pulled up on the toilet seat so no one would notice me and make me go to bed. But my first week of classes proved one dire fact. I am very far behind my classmates. They play on a level I didn't even know kids my age could. And if I'm going to catch up and earn my place here, I can't waste time sleeping. So I'm tired and cranky, and my feet are sore from being squished inside my tiny shoes all week. At the end of the first day of class, I shoved my old boots deep into the closet. If being the perfect Mistwick musician means curling my toes all day and hobbling a bit when I walk, so be it. Mrs. LaRue herself walks out. I haven't seen her since the planting ceremony. Today, she wears a bright, multicolored caftan. A gold comb in her hair sends up a spray of feathers that sway as she crosses to the microphone. Good morning, students. Today's lesson is one of the most important you will learn here, she says. I sit up straighter. If it's important enough they'll call a full assembly and Mrs. LaRue, I better not miss a word. I know you've all heard the rules of music craft over and over again. We all groan, nodding. But Mrs. LaRue doesn't smile. Unfortunately, sometimes we can hear a thing so many times that it begins to lose its meaning. Tell me, students, what is the second rule of music craft? Together we recite, lest you be doomed by your own art, always finish what you start. Mrs. LaRue nods seriously. We all know what this rhyme means, that it is very dangerous to leave a spell unfinished. An incomplete spell leaves all sorts of uncontrolled and unstable forces hanging about. She takes a long pause, letting the words sink in as her eyes slowly sweep over our faces. I know the rule well. It's why when you're just practicing a spell, you should always skip the first few notes, so you don't create any magic that might get out of control. Playing a few measures over and over in practice is harmless, but if you start at the beginning, trigger the magic, and then don't finish it, you end up with a spoiled spell, and those can be very dangerous depending on how powerful the spell is. Even if you mess up, you have to pull it together and keep going, or let someone else jump in and finish the spell for you, which is always embarrassing. Often in your life, Mrs. LaRue continues, you will find yourself playing in situations that are distracting or unsettling. Anger, sadness, and other powerful emotions can compromise your composure, causing errors or even preventing you from completing your spell. Sometimes you'll be with other musicians, who can close the spell if you're unable. But the leading cause of magical injury, from bruised hands to charred instruments, comes from unfinished solo spells, especially if you're dealing with maestro-level magic. I swallow hard, thinking suddenly of my mom. Is that what happened to her? Did she fail to complete a spell? Mrs. LaRue flicks a finger, and the four class maestros come walking solemnly onto the stage. Miss Nurani, Mr. Walter, Miss Becker, and Mr. Pinwhistle. They stand in a row and watch us grimly. I start to feel uneasy, wondering where this is leading. It doesn't sound like we'll be peeling apples or conjuring butterflies. Mr. Pinwhistle's sour gaze sweeps over us and lingers a second too long on me, and I could swear his nose wrinkles a little more than usual. Each of you will soon enter a room, Mrs. LaRue says, and there you will play a simple spell. Meanwhile, your maestros will be playing another spell that you will not be able to hear, but you will see its effects. They will try to unsettle you, to make you angry, afraid, even terribly sad. Your simple task will be to control yourself and finish what you start. Play through the emotions. As she leans into the microphone, it's like she's staring straight into my soul. I cannot impress upon you the importance of this exercise, except to say that one day your lives may depend upon it. With that, she leaves the stage, vanishing as suddenly as she appeared. In silent, solemn rows, we file out of the auditorium and through a door that leads behind the stage. There, we find a bunch of little soundproof rooms, sort of like the cubicles in the Aero classroom, except these ones aren't see-through. We're split into lines to take our turns four at a time. I don't know which maestro I'm paired with, but I assume it's Mr. Pinwhistle. I end up in the back of my line. Jai is at the back of his too, and he gives me a smile, but it's a weak one. So we finally found something that makes Jai Kapoor nervous. That doesn't make me feel the least bit better. We can't see into or hear anything coming out of the practice rooms, so I have no idea what form the exercise will take. As the kids ahead of me finish their turns and leave, they don't stick around to give the rest of us tips. Instead, most of them hurry away as fast as they can, looking like they're about to puke. A lot of them are crying. One girl sinks into the corner, hugging her viola, shaking so badly I worry she's in shock. But then Miss March appears and takes her gently away. Jai and I exchange looks. "Did your parents ever tell you about this?" I whisper. He shakes his head. It reminds me a little of the auditions, which, of course, sets me to panicking. Then I remember the point of this is to not panic, so I start panicking about panicking. Great. This is going to go fan-fiddle-tastically. Finally, my turn comes. Rabia leaves the room I'm about to enter, sobbing quietly, trembling so much she can barely move her cello. I give her a questioning look, hoping she'll give me some clue what to expect. But she just shakes her head and shuffles away. "Good luck," Jai whispers, before stepping into his little room. Drawing a deep breath, I walk inside, shutting the door behind me. My hands are sweating so much that I worry I'll drop my flute. I wipe them on my skirt and look around. There's not much to see, just padded walls and a bare linoleum floor, and a metal stand with a 3-page spell on it. Someone has written in tiny letters by the door, "It's all an illusion. Keep your cool." Thanks, random student. That's very reassuring. No one tells me what to do, so I figure I'm just supposed to start. First, I read through the pages. It's Reverie, an illusion spell by Claude Debussy for conjuring light. I find the fingerings easily enough. It's not an easy spell, but it's not too difficult either, as long as I keep my cool. I play slowly, lips pursed slightly as I blow across the embouchure. I miss a few notes, which is to be expected since I haven't played this piece before, But the important thing is to keep playing, even through the mistakes. The melody that fills the little room is dreamy and haunting and a little sad. But that's not the only reason a shiver runs through me. I'm waiting for something to happen, to try and trip me up. I wish they'd at least told us what to expect. My feet pinch, and I shift my weight to try and take pressure off them, which nearly makes me fall over. Keep your cool, Amelia, I think. Just keep your cool. Illusion is a type of elemental spell, so the magic that begins to peel away from the flute is pale blue, like shimmering sapphire dust. It twinkles and fades, and in front of me, a white orb begins to grow. At first, it's faint, little more than a fleck of light. But the deeper I get into the music, the brighter it becomes. It's just like the ones Miss Nurani made when we were hunting for my echo tree. It's beautiful. I'm so focused on watching it and reading the music that I don't notice at first that the light around me is dimming. The room is getting darker and colder. Soon, the only light I have to read the music by is my glowing white orb. It hovers over the stand, while the walls, floor, and ceiling fade away into infinite blackness. It's like standing in the heart of the night, with no horizon in view. Nothing exists but the sheets of music, my flute, the ball of light, and me. Unease stirs inside my stomach. I press it down, thinking, it's just an illusion. I imagine Mr. Pinwhistle on the other side of the wall, blasting his bassoon and flooding my little room with his illusions. But then I start to feel heat behind me. I don't turn, I don't take my eyes off the music, but I sense flames leaping up. Then they spread around me, hot and red and angry, until I'm standing in a circle of crackling fire. For an illusion, it feels incredibly real. I begin to sweat from the heat. Panic sparks like fireworks in my chest. The flames are everywhere, hungry and relentless. Unlike the illusion Miss Nurani did at the planting ceremony, this fire actually feels hot. Is it real? Would they trap me in here with an actual fire?
Whatever your mother tried to do that night by the river, it didn't work,
I hear Graham saying in the back of my mind.
And it killed her.
I push away her words. Now is not the time to think about my mom, especially not how she died, or I'll almost definitely fall to pieces and fail this test. Finally, the fire fades away, and something inside me unclenches as it does. The room grows lighter until I can see it's not the same room at all. Instead, I'm standing in the ballroom at the hotel where the auditions were held. My blue light is still hovering overhead, but it's harder to see in this bright room. There's a little acorn in a pot in front of me, and the four maestros are seated behind it. They all stare at me with different expressions. Mr. Pinwhistle looks enraged, Mr. Walters looks bored, Miss Becker looks disgusted, and Miss Nurani looks deeply disappointed. Those looks drag at me like chains around my neck. For a moment, I forget I'm at Mistwick. I think I really am in that ballroom, failing all over again, destroying my own dream, risking everything for silly, stupid hope. Nervousness and shame fill my cheeks with heat. My hands get clammy. I play and play, but the acorn doesn't so much as jiggle. It's not working. I'm going to get kicked out. I'm going to lose everything I ever wanted. It's all an illusion. Keep your cool. The words come just when I need them. Though I'm trembling all over, I force my hands to stay steady. Then the maestros start whispering.
You're not good enough,
says Mr. Pinwhistle.
Why don't you just give up?
Asks Mr. Walters.
Is that chicken poop?
Miss Becker wrinkles her nose. Miss Nurani just shakes her head and adds,
We don't want girls like you. You don't belong here, Amelia Jones. The real Amelia belonged. We wanted her, but we got you instead.
It takes all my might not to whip my flute from my lips and yell that they're all wrong, that I do belong here. At least, that's what I think I'd shout if I could.
but a part of me knows they're right. I don't belong at Mistwick. I'm not the real Amelia. I was never meant to be here. I don't know how I keep playing, but I do. Sheer stubbornness, I guess. I always did have a head like a mule, Gran would say. So out of pure spite, I keep playing, because they can whisper all they want. The louder I play, the harder it gets to hear them. Then they vanish like smoke. The room goes dark again, leaving me alone with my music and the bobbing ball of light. Except for the soft notes of my flute, there's total silence. My heart lifts. The test must be over. Everything comes in threes, right? I passed three tests: darkness, fire, and the audition. And I'm still playing strong. I may have wobbled a bit and missed a note or two, but I didn't quit. They didn't beat me. But I still have one page of music left to play, and the lights don't come on yet. It's just me, standing in a pool of light, my glowing orb floating like a bright bubble over my head. I feel like I've been standing here for ages. My legs are sore, my hands and arms are tired from holding up my flute, and I'm losing my breath. Shifting slightly to give my legs a break, I feel something against my shoe. Something like water? I chance a look down between notes and see I'm standing in an inky puddle, or not a puddle, a wide, shallow pool, and that pool is getting deeper. In seconds, the water is to my knees, then my waist. A current rises, pushing against me like I'm standing in a river that's getting stronger and stronger. Looking around, I don't see anything but dark, rising water. The light of my illusion spell ripples on the choppy surface. The water reaches my chest. I raise my arms so it can't throw off my playing. I wonder if the maestros use the same illusions on all the kids, and if so, how did Rabia manage this test with her cello? The thought comes and goes like a fly, and soon all I can focus on is keeping my flute above water. The stand with the papers somehow stays still, but the current is so strong now that I can barely stay on my feet. I brace against the flow, convinced the test has to end soon, or I'll be completely submerged in water. Just an illusion. Keep your cool. But it doesn't end. The water reaches my chin. Only my hands and flute and head are above the surface. The current drags at me hungrily. Despite my efforts, my fingers grow clumsy and I hit a few bad notes, and the ball of light shrinks to the size of a pea. I'm standing chin deep in a powerful river in almost total darkness. I keep playing, desperate and terrified, trying to remember the last few measures of the spell, since the light isn't strong enough to illuminate the pages. The notes jumble in my head, and I frantically pound the keys of my flute, but the ball of light doesn't grow again. Then I see something. A girl, standing in the corner of the room. She's so faint I can barely make her out, but something about her is familiar. Her features are blurred, like she's a watercolor painting. Is she part of the illusion? She watches me silently, with eyes like gaping holes. A shiver runs over my skin. Then she starts toward me. I back away, fighting against the current, but the water doesn't seem to slow her down. She raises a hand, which is pale white and transparent. I shake my head, still playing my flute, telling myself she isn't real, isn't real, isn't... Losing my balance, I plunge underwater. This isn't an illusion. It's a memory. I'm sinking, drowning, clawing for air that I cannot find. Instead of my 12-year-old body, I feel small and weak, 4 years old again. I can't seem to remember how to swim. I'm totally at the river's mercy, and it is merciless. Opening my mouth to scream, I shut my eyes and twist this way and that, terror coursing through me. I can feel myself getting weak, sparks dance in my eyes. I'm drowning. I'm drowning, and I'm reaching for my mother, but she isn't there. She was there. She was there beside me, and so was my father. But I slipped and fell into the river, and they called my name, but the current carried me swiftly away.
out of their arms, into total darkness. The lights come on, revealing the little soundproof room. I'm curled up into a ball on the floor, sobbing for Gran. There's no water anywhere, except for my salty tears and the snot running from my nose. It was an illusion after all, but my body reacted as if it were real.